If you missed any of this series, we always have it online and all that good stuff. So today is another fascinating story of from God's Word, in which we get to see some things that are going to teach us some new things. I really believe they do. And so we're going to just jump right in. I hope that's okay. This particular story I heard some years ago or some time ago from a somebody else taught it, and I just was fascinated by the story, and so I dug into it more myself, and I've really enjoyed it, and here we go. So chapter 5, verse 1. Y'all ready? Now Naaman was commander of the army, the king of Aram. And he was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. So there's a nation named Aram, and Aram has a king. And a guy that works for the king is named Naaman. All right, this is where we're at in the verse. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. So this sentence, very first verse, is like loaded with significance. And we're going to be jumping into this story quick, I get it, but I think we're going to get somewhere fast with this. The writer places some huge contradictions, some huge paradox right here in this first sentence, and you can probably figure out what it is, right? There's these statements that he is a great man. He is like this valiant soldier. The king of Aram thinks he has favor with him. And yet, at the very end, what does it say? But he has leprosy, right? So this is a great, I use the word paradox. It creates tension in the first. This is not normal. This is like watching the scene of a movie, and the movie is like this great, you know, amazing soldier at the beginning that everybody loves. But then in the same scene, you're also introduced to the fact that everybody hates him. And you're like, how does that even make sense? This is the scene because lepers in an ancient world, as you guys are probably aware of, they are the outcasts. They're rejected. They're marginalized. They're the ones that nobody wants to be around. That's a leper. And so how is a man great and esteemed by the king, yet he's a leper? How does that even work? So this first sentence is just all sorts of whack. Here we go. All right, verse 2. Now bands of raiders from Aram, not to be confused with those pesky ones from Oakland, had gone out. Thank you. And had taken captive of a young girl from Israel. She served Naaman's wife. So Aram, a country, is at war with Israel. They are neighboring countries, and they are doing all sorts of warlike things, like taking slaves, right? So Naaman's wife has a girl from Israel. Verse 3. She said to her mistress, meaning the slave girl said to her mistress, if only my master, Naaman, would see the prophet who is in Samaria. And Samaria is where? It is in Israel. He would cure him of his leprosy. Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. By all means, go, the king of Aram replied. I will send a letter to the king of Israel. So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, FYI, 750 pounds of silver. That's a lot. 6,000 shekels of gold, FYI, 150 pounds of gold, and 10 sets of clothing, FYI, there was a sale at the Gap, okay? The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, with this letter I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy. All right, I want to show you a map. How many of you guys like geography? Any geography people? Like three of us? Okay, so pop quiz, where are we in the world here? Okay, so if we don't take the X for it, if we just look at that, you got Europe, of course, the Mediterranean Sea there in the middle, North Africa on the bottom, and then the Middle East over to the right, right? And so if you go right of the boot, right, because the boot is that's the only country in the world people know, the boot, the right of it, where the X is, X marks the spot of Israel, okay? And so that's really simple geography, geographical orientation 101. We are now smarter because of it. All right, next slide, zooming in to Israel. Boom. Mediterranean Sea on the left. And you have a country called Aram above Israel. You can see Aram, which is modern-day Syria. You guys know Syria, maybe? Syria. And at the top of the map, you see a dot that says Damascus. Damascus is the capital of Syria, where this exchange or this little scene with the letter and the shopping spree at Gap, all that takes place in Damascus. Okay, and so Damascus is where the king of Aram is, it's where Naaman is, and then there's Israel to the south, and there's this slave girl that says, I know somebody in a place called Samaria, which you can see Samaria on the map. If you go there, he can hook you up with this, like, this, you know, leprosy thing you got going on, because I don't know if you just noticed, like, your little pinky just fell off, and you probably should hurry, you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of the situation. And she's going, I could help you, because I got a guy who can hook you up if you just go to Samaria. So that's the scene, and that's the map, and you can keep that up for just a minute. But what's especially interesting about this kind of area, and even if you see the map, you can see the dotted lines, kind of where the countries are divided, but most countries believed, and most people believed, that gods, if you will, and the god of a certain, there was a god of a certain country or space or place, and so people would adopt different gods, and the king of Aram, he worshipped, and then therefore the whole country worshipped, the nation worshipped, a god called Ramon. Now, Ramon was just a god, a little g god. He was just a dude that they thought was really powerful. He eventually becomes the god of the sun, which eventually becomes Greek god Zeus in mythology, which we all are familiar with him. So Ramon is the root of Zeus, if you will. And that has nothing to do with where we're going, but nonetheless, it's interesting. So Aram, in this place, in their little country, they worship Ramon. But Israel, they don't worship Ramon. We all are familiar with the Israel story. If we have been in church in any amount of time, they worshiped a god that they believed was the creator of all, and they called him Yahweh. And Yahweh in your Bible, if you're reading through the Old Testament, it's when it's capitalized and it says the Lord. Well, the Lord is when they would actually use the word Yahweh in the written word. That's when we read the Lord, that's Yahweh. And so they see, if you will, that there's a god in this other country. And the God of Yahweh could maybe do something for this problem of leprosy. So we should send them down to their God, because apparently our God can't. And so they decide that they should head south, which I think is interesting, right? They have a God they worship. They think he's probably not up for the job. Let's send him down there. Verse 7. As soon as the king of Israel read the letter. Okay, the letter has got to Israel. This is awesome. The king of, it gets to Israel. He tore his robes and says, am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of leprosy? See how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me? And to which we are like, try the decaf, dude, you know? Like, calm down. It's okay. It's just some gold, a few shirts. No big deal. But this guy's freaking out, right? There's some irony here. And this is really kind of, there is some humor in the story, because here you have the king of Israel, the king of the land that worships Yahweh, that doesn't, and then some guy comes in and says, hey, I hear you have a pretty powerful king that can maybe cure me of my leprosy, and he starts freaking out and tearing his robes, right? Which apparently is a sign of I am a distraught person. If I ever tear my shirt open, just know I'm upset. I may not be Superman, but I'm upset, right, Dale? So, see, he's tearing his robe, and so Naaman, who is a worshiper of Ramon, seems to have more faith in Yahweh than the king of Israel. So this is like an interesting another paradox in the story, where people who aren't supposed to have faith in Yahweh do, and the people who are supposed to have faith in Yahweh don't. Huh? So here we go, right? And so this is what's happening. And then you get to verse 8. When Elisha, the man of God, the one that girl had talked to him about, right? When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him a message. Why have you torn your robes? Come on, man. Lay off the Red Bull. That's what he's saying. Have the man come to me, and he will know that there's a prophet in Israel. So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger, which I think is just great. The guy shows up on his front lawn, and he sends out someone else. So he sends out a messenger, and the messenger says to him, go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed. So again, let's back up. This guy is a great man. He's been sent by the king of Aram. He shows up on the front lawn, if you think of that way. He shows up on the front lawn of Elisha. He's this great man. He's got an entourage with him. He's got horses and chariots. Modern day language, he's got tanks and trucks. Okay, I mean, this is like military strength coming up to the lawn of this guy who's like a hermit, right? He's like Yoda in a hut, and he's about to give him his Jedi ways. Go wash in the Jordan 7 times, sent by my messenger, right? And so it's just, kind of this hilarious scene in some ways in which this powerful, great man apparently shows up and he's not even greeted by Elisha. He sends out his intern to do the talking for him, right? And so this is what happens. And then verse 11, this one goes to 11, but Naaman went away angry and said, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers in Damascus, better than the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed? So he turned and went off in a rage. So Naaman is mad. He's angry. He's come all this way, and Elijah sends out a messenger to meet him. It's like, dude, I got horses and chariots. I'm a big deal. And you send out a messenger. And then you tell me to go take a bath in the Jordan. He's mad. Can you kind of understand it a little bit? I mean, he's came a long ways. And then he's just basically like, it feels like he's just been sloughed off. Like, dude, whatever, man. Just go bathe in the Jordan. Hopefully you'll be all right. Go back to Aram. That's what he feels. And so he's upset. And he's not happy, and he thought that he was going to like show up, and Elijah would do this big ritual and like call on the name of his God, and there would just be this big scene in which like fireworks are going off, and then he like Benny Hinn's him, and he's all good, right? And that's what they're thinking. That's what he's seeing is like, I'm going to be good because he's going to have this big scene for me. And sometimes I think that's kind of the way we feel like it should go. He's this important person, and he's asked to do something small. First of all, he's kind of treated small, isn't he? And then he's asked to do something small and simple. He's asked to have the faith to go wash in the Jordan. He wants something big that seems worthy of his time and effort and coming, seems worthy of his stature, seems worthy of who he is. But he's asked to do something that isn't big. So let's take a moment. Let's reflect on this. Let's ask ourselves if there's any of us in this. Because maybe, perhaps, there are. Because my greatest experiences, if you will, my greatest growth in Christ, and see if you're with me on this, have been really being faithful in the simple everyday things that God places in front of me in my life. They're typically small. The greatest areas of my growth have been in those small things. Yet, although I know that to be true, I'm constantly on the lookout and wanting some gigantic, huge thing to let me have giant leaps forward in which I can go, wow, aha, look what God did, and I can celebrate that hugeness of God showing up and showing off on my behalf. And in some ways, you're like, maybe I'm not either, but there is this, to me, reality about the way we see small things and the way we see big things, because for me, we grow when we do the right things every day with the small things that God places in front of us. It's the cumulative effect of what faith can be. And so pride is such a debilitating thing to this, because this is what Naaman is experiencing. Pride is this debilitating thing to our faith because we think something has to be bigger or something has to be more magnificent or a bigger magnitude. And so when it comes to our relationship with God, we have these experiences in life in which we can categorize them as big and we kind of ride the wave of the big one, but yet we struggle when it comes to the small, and we look kind of down our noses at them, if you will, and we don't give them much energy because they don't seem that significant. Because the small things are hard, aren't they? The small things are very hard. Are they? Doing the consistent small things on a daily basis are hard. They just are. Let's think about this in the form of trash. Stay with me. Let's just say that we decided... I've been thinking about this lately, by the way. I've been thinking about the human capacity to do good, for human good. Meaning, I believe that we are created with this natural instinct to do good. And you're going, well, I thought we were created with a sin nature. No, we're created for good, And we fall victim, so to speak, to the temptation of sin. But we are created with good. Our identity is not rooted in bad. That's a big difference, by the way, from what most of us grew up believing about our identity and who we are. But that's another message. So here's the thing. So there's this human capacity for good. It's the instinct that's in us when we see a piece of trash that isn't where it's supposed to be, that we feel like, should I pick it up and put it in a trash can? And some of us do that and some of us don't. But nonetheless, let's imagine that we all do, okay? And let's just imagine the simple act of picking up a piece of trash every day. Go along with me on this. Let's just play this out. If the little things might perhaps matter quite a bit, if we just picked up one piece of trash every day, what kind of difference would it make? You're going, what? We're talking about trash. Yes, we are. And we're not going to make this piece of trash a little gum wrapper, okay? It's not that small, but it's also not one of those random mattresses you see on the side of the road, okay? I have no idea where those stray mattresses come from, but they're all over the place. I'm just like, another mattress. I don't want to think about that mattress, but why is it there? Anyway, we're going to make our piece of trash today. Let's average it out to the size of a Coke bottle, okay? A 20-oz plastic Coke bottle. You will forever now say Oz. I have said it for a long time in my life. Just like the filet mignon. I'll take a 7-oz filet mignon. That'll get them at the restaurant. And they're like, and they think I'm serious, but anyway, and I am. So the 20-oz plastic bottle, okay? It's a Coke bottle, mellow yellow, whatever you want to be. Big red. I don't care what you're drinking. But, well, I do care. But, there's a bottle on the ground and you see it and you decide you're going to pick it up. Let's just take the cumulative effect of a year. Every day you decide to pick up that bottle or a bottle like it. Well, in 1 year's time, this is pretty simple. A bottle weighs 7 ounces. It's about 11 inches tall. In 1 year, you're going to pick up 160 pounds of plastic. Okay. And you're going to put it in a recycling bin. And if you stacked all those bottles on top of each other, they would equal 335 feet tall, which is as tall as a large sequoia redwood tree. Has anybody ever seen a sequoia redwood tree? A sequoia redwood tree. Yeah, there's a few of us. And they are massive, huge. You're like, wow. And so in 1 year, you'd pick up that much plastic. But let's just say you said the cumulative effect of me doing the little things consistently. Do they matter? Let's just play it out. Let's just say 40 years, okay? Most of us will live past 40, but we'll just take 40 years. We picked up this game at age 40, and so we're going to start doing it for 40 next years. In 40 years, you would pick up 6,400 pounds of plastic. That's over 3 tons, right? 6,400 pounds of plastic, and they would stack 13,400 feet in the air, which is the equivalent of 11 Empire State Buildings on top of one another, okay? So this is just like one of those crazy math things that, you know, and by the way, I did all that right now in my head. I did not prepare this part of the message. I'm not only a geography person, but mathematics is not too bad either. But anyway, here's the thing. I think the little things, and some of you are wondering, so are we all about trash? You know, is that our new mission statement? You know, we pick up trash. OKC community. It's not about the 20-oz bottle, is it? It's about the act of saying, I'm going to stay consistent in the small things because I believe the cumulative effect of the small things matter. And here's the thing. This is really huge when it comes to our faith, isn't it? Because here's what we do. We sacrifice praying every day because it doesn't seem like it makes a big difference. I'm just praying. We sacrifice reading the word consistently because we feel like I'm just reading another chapter I've already read before. Does it really matter? We sacrifice, like, oh, I got gung-ho about learning my neighbor's names and getting to know them, but I've kind of gotten a little bored of that, and I'm busy doing other things, so I'm no longer really efforting with my neighbors as much as I should, even though Jesus' greatest command is to love your neighbor. You know, love God, love the Lord with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor. But yet, my loving the neighbor thing, the consistent small things of me just figuring out how to love them, I might do something once or twice this year, maybe. And so the little things matter. And so here's this story, right? This playing out in which we on the surface, we think this has nothing to do with our life. And here's Naaman complaining and angry that Elisha wouldn't give him this big, magnificent thing, and that he asked him to do something small. And he said, the small thing is insignificant. It's not important enough. It's not where God's supposed to be. God's in the big things. That's what Naaman thought, right? And he said, no, just go take a bath in the Jordan. And he's going, I don't want to go wash in the nasty Jordan River. Damascus is so much better. That's what he says. Verse 13. Naaman's servants, man, these servants are good in this story, went to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, isn't that what we just said? Would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed? So he went down. He was convinced easily, apparently. So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times. As the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became like that of a young boy. Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. I love it. It's like, load up the tanks, we're heading back. He stood before him and said, so he's standing before Elisha. So Elisha comes out and sees him this time. Now I know that there is no God in all the world except Israel. Now, this is a huge statement, like way bigger than we get it. We're like, oh, cool. The guy's like, oh, he loves Jesus now. In this case, he loves Yahweh now, right? Like what's different about this and why this is a huge deal is he doesn't say, hey, I acknowledge that Yahweh exists, or I praise Yahweh that he has healed me. No, he says something completely different. There is no other God in all the world except Yahweh. Now, this is huge in the ancient world because most of these people, if you see that map up there, people in Aram believe that all other sorts of gods exist. Their God in their country and their place in the world was Ramon. But you know what? Hey, it's pretty cool that they have Yahweh down there in Israel. That's why we're going to go down there and see if he can cleanse me of leprosy. They believed in multiple gods. They did not have a problem with there being multiple gods. And so it was no problem for Naaman to go down and to not only acknowledge Yahweh, but to continue to worship Ramon. But he doesn't say, I now acknowledge that Yahweh is a powerful God. No, he acknowledges and says there's no other God in the world except Yahweh. It's a big deal. It's huge because he's denouncing all the existence of all other gods, including Ramon. See, this is pretty huge because this is countercultural. This is not the way it usually went. It would have been more common for him to say, you know, now he's one of my gods I worship, all that good stuff. Verse 15. So please accept a gift from your servant. He's telling Elisha, I want to give you a gift. The prophet answers, as surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept a thing. And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. If you will not, said Naaman, please let your servant be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry. For your servant will never again make a burnt offering and sacrifice for any other god but the Lord. So this is an interesting little statement. Give me enough earth that my mules can carry. I want some dirt. You got any dirt, man? That's what he's asking. Like, can I have some dirt and put it on my mules and take it back? What is that about? Like, it's out of nowhere. Like, why does he want dirt? And I'm sure Elijah's like, yeah, bro, you can take some dirt, man. Whatever you want. He wants dirt because he believes, again, gods are connected to places. He wants some of the earth from Israel. Because he wants to go back and spread it out in his backyard. And when he makes sacrifices, he can go stand on the dirt of Israel. Because that earth is connected to Yahweh. So here's the thing that's interesting. Is Naaman is starting to get it. He's starting to figure out what it means that God is the God of all. But he doesn't quite get it, right? Because he thinks he's got to take Israel with him. But he doesn't really need to take him. Because God is everywhere. Yahweh's in Aram, just like he's in Israel. But he doesn't quite get it. Believe it or not, he didn't quite understand the whole God thing yet. He's like still trying to figure out. There's some questions about God. Because he's really different than us, right? He hadn't quite figured out God. So he's struggling with this a little bit, but he just says, yeah, take some dirt, whatever you want to do, man, whatever works, or floats your boat. Verse 18. But may the Lord forgive your servant for this one thing. This is an interesting statement, like fascinating to me and kind of where we'll kind of start getting close to wrapping up. But may the Lord forgive your servant of this one thing. When my master enters the temple, meaning the king of Aram, when he enters the temple of Ramon, there's that Ramon that we've been talking about. Shows up in the story, to bow down, and he is leaning on my arm, I have to bow down there also. When I bow down in the temple of Ramon, may the Lord forgive your servant of this. Kind of an interesting, like, he's already predicting. He's like, here's the deal, Elisha. I got to go back to work. I have to go back to my everyday job, and here's the deal. Like, I'm sort of a big deal in Aram. I'm kind of the king's right-hand man. And he's going to walk in, and he's going to want to go into the temple of Ramon, and he's going to want to bow down. And when he bows down, I'm going to have to bow down as well. Is that okay? Are you cool with that? Are we like, this is what he's asking. And what? So, you know, we're thinking, what is Elijah going to say? He's going to say, man, no way, bro. You can't do that. That's crazy. You now worship the God. You worship Yahweh. You can't turn or burn, man. Like, that's the way it is. No compromise. You know what I mean? Like, you cannot bow down. That's what you're thinking Elijah's going to say, right? This is what Elijah says. He's like, man, you just can't go back there, apparently. Maybe you should just stay here in Israel. I got a room in the back. You can join my God squad. It'll all be good. Right? That's what we think Elijah's going to say. But what does he say? Verse 19. Go in peace. Now, we've talked about the word peace a few times, and the Hebrew word for peace is shalom. And shalom is this humongous word in the Hebrew language that has a very all-encompassing kind of meaning. And one of the things it really means is that it's going to, not just peace, but it's going to be this complete unity and favor and blessing of God. So you are, in essence, when you are going in peace, you are having the full covenant of God with you. And so he's saying, go back to Aram, and God is with you. Hey, I'm going to have to bow down to the Ramon. Are you cool there? Are we good? Go in peace. Isn't that an interesting statement? I mean, what is really going on here? And Naaman's like, I have to go back to work, and they worship a different thing there. They're not really into Yahweh. And he says, go in peace. And I wonder for us today, there's a long story to get to a couple of really important things for us today. I wonder how many of us go in environments and work in environments that it's not easy to live our faith. You know what I mean by that? I wonder how many of us have situations that when we feel like Jesus is really welcome, meaning maybe in our school or in our home, and maybe even in our homes. The building that you go into every day, if you will, Jesus isn't really celebrated there. And you're like, well, how do I figure this out? Because here's the thing, like following Jesus and all that kind of stuff, it's really easy. Here's the trite, easy way to say it, is just follow Jesus and he'll tell you the right things to do. But that's not really the way it works, right? I mean, that is so, like, that is not real. Following Jesus is difficult. It's hard. It's hairy, if you will. It's foggy and fuzzy, and you don't always know what to do. Because some things don't necessarily, let's just say it this way. You have a relationship with a friend, but this friend is far, far away from God, and you're always struggling in your mind, do I stay with them and, like, try and, like, be there for them, or do I separate myself from them and their sin and their crazy ways? And we have this struggle, don't we? Like, where is my role as a follower of Jesus in this? What is my role in? I'm in this environment every day at work in which it's debilitating and it's heartless and people don't care about me and people are mean to one another. And I'm in this environment every day and I go, why am I here, God? Is anybody with me? Is this real? Like, this idea of following Jesus in these places. And if you want to call them, I mean, maybe they aren't necessarily worshiping Ramon, but they're like these temples of Ramon, right? There's these places that have nothing to do with Jesus that we're put into, and we're supposed to be followers of Jesus. And we're just going, where's my holy huddle, you know? Where's the place I can just go and retreat and just be with people that really believe what I believe? And so sometimes I hear stories and I hear conversations with people, and it's like, I don't think I can do this anymore. I don't think I can do what I'm doing anymore because it's just not feeding my faith. And so I need to get out of it, and I need to go over here, and I want to do this. And there's this conversation that unfolds. And today, I don't think this is everybody in the room, but I think there's a lot of people in the room that need to hear something very specific, that God has you where he has you for a really important reason. Go in peace. God is with you. And you know what? When you do the little things that God puts in front of you, and you're faithful to the little things, it will add up and it will make a difference. And sometimes when you think nothing is making a difference that you're doing, and the things that you're doing to be a good person, a loving person, the things that you're doing to share your faith in just small, subtle ways, because you know that coming in and being like, because here's the thing though, right? Because every once in a while you're gonna have this opportunity to tell a story, but sometimes you just don't. And sometimes the church is really guilty of saying, go tell your story and just celebrate Jesus and talk about Jesus. You can't always do that. You need moments when people who are the powers that be in your life bow down to the wrong thing, like chasing money and doing other things that you don't believe quite in. And you're like, how do I reconcile this in my heart? How do I figure this out? See, scripture is not always black and white. There are, and this isn't always a popular thing to say, there are hundreds of shades of gray. And is not compromising. It is not watering down the gospel to go and be places and to commit to places that are about other gods. It is not. It is realizing that there will be moments where you just have the subtle, small, little things to do that will cumulatively add up to a mountain, to 11 skyscrapers of good. It just takes time, and it takes commitment to the small things. Because you know when Naaman went back, right? He has no leprosy. What does this king, the king of Aram, the king who worships Iran, what does he say? So there are these moments of breakthrough, right? What does he say? Naaman, my son, you look like your skin is that of a young boy. Tell me what has happened. That's how he talked it. And then Naaman has this story to tell, right? About how there's a God named Yahweh in Israel who healed him. And that's a good story to tell. There will be moments like that, but more than often, there won't be moments like that. There will be moments when it's about the small little things, because faith is about the humble acts of doing the everyday things that God places in front of you. And trusting that going washing the Jordan doesn't make any sense. It seems humbling and kind of silly. And, you know, nobody really is acknowledging me and who I am and all that good stuff. But it's saying, I'm going to do that. Because that's what God's put in front of me. I'm going to trust that he is doing something. I'm going to close with this. By the way, before I read a passage, I'm going to read Mark 5. I keep saying the little things matter, but, you know, we often look for the big and significant, but most often God is in the small and humble. And I say that statement, it means a lot to me. We look for the big and significant, but most often God is in the small and the humble. Mark 5. I close with this. Mark 5 is a story in which Jesus is doing his thing, you know, doing his ministry, all the good stuff that he does. And he comes across a guy who's a demon-possessed man, which is, you know, crazy, right? And so there's this demon-possessed man, and everybody's freaking him out about this guy. And Jesus comes, and he does what he does. The demons know who he is. They start talking to him and say, please have mercy on us, Jesus. Jesus casts the demons out. The demon-possessed man then becomes thankful and... he follows Jesus, right? He's like, all about, I'm going to follow Jesus. And in verse 18, we get to the story. It says, as Jesus was getting in the boat, meaning he's about to leave, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him. Isn't that crazy? I want to follow you, Jesus. Nope. You're not coming with me on this one, buddy. But said, go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis, which the Decapolis, I've talked about it not that long ago, is an area in Israel, but it had become a really heavily Greek area. It's about an area of 10 cities, heavily Greek, very non-Jewish, very secular, if you will, worshiping all sorts of other types of gods. And he goes to the Decapolis, that's his home. How much has Jesus, or go to the Decapolis, and how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people who heard about him in the Decapolis were amazed. Maybe God is saying to you today, I need you right where I have you.